Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is the second in the Commonwealth Club Social Entrepreneurship Series. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club and your moderator. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Ms. Conchi Bretos, founder of MIA Consulting, Ashoka Fellow, and 2009 Purpose Prize winner. After a successful career in local politics, Conchi in 1993 was appointed Florida Secretary for Aging and Adult Services. This position allowed her to see firsthand the living conditions of many of Florida's low-income elderly. She soon figured out that there were better ways to get them the assistance they need, but still allow them to stay in their homes and maintain a sense of dignity and quality of life. Today, she runs a consulting company that has helped 40 public housing projects in 12 states bring assisted living services to their residents. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Conchi Bretos.
Thank you, Ruth. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club, Ruth Shapiro in particular, and everybody that had a hand in getting me here tonight. And I come today with a great sense of optimism. It has not always been that way. I am really optimistic about the way changes are occurring in the United States. I think we are experiencing an era of new thinking and new knowledge that is going to make the unattainable attainable. This new thinking that we are witnesses today, especially social entrepreneurs that have to deal with all kinds of social issues, is characterized by synthesis and a broad vision. We view the world in a different way today that we did or that I did when I started my long trip 25 years ago as a global society, and that has had great repercussions in how we think and how we solve problems. There are today people all over the world looking at common problems and finding global solutions to the problems, the societal problems that we face. A perfect example of that new thinking is Mark Freeman of the NCORE career movement. Mark has been able to demonstrate without any doubt that elders, older people, are best engaged and at work. And he is making old age not only acceptable, but inviting. Just imagine that when the baby boomers retire, if they retire, they will leave behind 34 million jobs. Economic activity will only produce 17 million jobs. So it is incumbent on us to follow Mark Freeman's example of engaging older people in constructive way, keeping them working, and particularly keeping them healthy. I believe that change is inevitable today, as it was not the case several years ago, because of two historical events. One, which I mentioned briefly, this global society in which we live, The realization that we are members of this global community and that as social beings we have to engage others in solving our problems. But not only that, it's the fact that whatever happens in Europe or in the Gulf or in Afghanistan is a problem that affects all of us. That if we don't reach out to others in solving those problems, it would ultimately affect us and implicate us. So I believe that that age of indifference that was one of the major obstacles in my life is over, is no longer an option for any of us. The other major event, historical event, is this, what we call the demographic tsunami, is the baby boomers. For the first time in the history of this country, older people will outnumber teenagers 2-to-1. And if you think that that has no impact in our daily life, you're wrong. This global aging and this aging of America, which still is a relatively young country compared to Italy and Japan, is creating havoc in every sector of our community. Social security, health care, social services. So it is imperative for us social entrepreneurs and for everybody to keep all people healthy, engaged, working, and producing all that vast experience that they have. Because I firmly believe, and I always believe this, that life stages are social constructs, that are not realities, that we set the stage of an older person at 65, and that's the age that they need to retire. Well, I'm 65, and I'm not planning to retire anytime soon. There's a lot of juice in me still. So we also realizing that our society drives when everybody in the society does. And if we want to impact global standard of living, we must create a world where everybody has to have a fair chance of aging with dignity. And yet aging in America and elsewhere continues to be a class divide. Those who are educated and affluent are healthier, live longer. Those who are poor don't follow the same destiny. We segregate all people, not to be seen or heard. They suffer in resignation and silence. We know so little about them. And I wonder why children don't see them as role models. I remember growing with my grandmother and deriving a lot of wisdom and guidance from her until she died. And it is a shame that in the United States we don't value the contributions of all people the way we do in other places. They are so systematically disadvantage, and I'm talking about the poor seniors and disabled adults, that I often wonder if we live in a just society. And I know that you're going to think I'm a kind of a revolutionary. And as a Cuban, we actually do revolutions very well. and I think that was the feeling of my mother when I was growing up. That was my thought in an afternoon of November 1994. I was in Tallahassee, and I was asked to travel to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. There was a building, elderly building, subsidized by public housing, where there had been a fire. 5 elder people died. 11 remained in the building, which was totally destroyed. They had no place to go. And when I arrived there, I saw things that put me to shame. I saw rat-infected apartments, rotten food, people laying in the bed on feces, surrounded by worms. And I said to myself, obviously, the world doesn't know about this. And as I do always, that has gotten me into a lot of trouble, I said to myself, I must be here for a reason. I think that I am the right person to change this. I need to tell everybody what is going on. And I had really no option but to act. And I usually do that. I like projects that are difficult, that have little chance of success. And I always thought that innovation has no basis in logical thought. When you are confronted with an issue like that, you act out of commitment, out of moral issues, and you don't stop and think. And that was the case when I, in 1996, lost my job in Tallahassee because of a change in administration, and I went home to Miami. And I was determined to speak out about the plight of older seniors and disabled adults. So I immediately went to see the housing authority director in Miami. I thought that I would have the greatest impact there because, after all, most of the elder poor live in public housing or in subsidized housing. I found a lot of non-believers in public housing. I found people that were not ready to change or see things differently. The question always arose about money. We don't have money to do this. But as it's been the case with me over and over again, the timing was just right for me. The day I arrived at the public housing in Miami, the director was trying to sell a building because it was totally deteriorated, and they have no funds to retrofit the building. It was being condemned. So he was going to give it away for almost nothing. So I asked him to give me the building, and I promised him, without knowing what it was going to take, that I would produce enough income to retrofit not only that building, the 70 other elderly buildings constructed back in 1950, at the end of 1 year. I went to Tallahassee, and I got $1.2 million in service funding, in Medicaid waiver. So he would not talk anymore about show me the money. 6 months after we opened that building and we started providing services, the 101 units were full, and we had 56 people on a waiting list. At the end of that first year, we were producing $500,000 in profit. Well, you can't call it profit because it's a non-for-profit entity. But it was revenues over expenses. At the end of the second year, we hit the $1 million mark. The Helen Sawyer Plaza building in Miami in 1998 became the model for the nation. It was published in many, many publications. It won 4 national awards. I've said to myself, this time I didn't fail. But my life is full of failures. And I have learned more from those failures than from my success. And you will think, why? It's because when you fail is when you realize how much you need to do to get there. I have never been afraid to fail. And in fact, I suggested to the president of Ashoka that should start recognizing people for their failures and not their accomplishments. It shows the true caliber of people when they fail and somehow they get out of a hole. And I always have tried and failed, but I have never failed to try. My mother claims, and she's still alive, and she's 91 years old, that I was always a very difficult child. that I had no fear, that I had a great contempt for authority, that I kept asking, what if we do things differently? So for her, it was very difficult to raise me. I had a tremendous amount of energy and curiosity. And I think that's how I began being a difficult child. And then there were events in my life that changed the course of where I'm going. In 1960, my parents were obsessed with the idea that their children were going to be taken away from them. They were going to be put in some kind of military camps, indoctrinated, brainwashed. She could not bear the thought of her children ending up in a military barrack. So, at age 14, she put both of us, my brother, 10 years of age, and myself, in a plane bound for the United States. We ended up in an orphanage in Lincoln, Nebraska, both him and I. And we were there for 4 years. Most people would probably feel that they have lost everything at that point. I felt a great sense of liberation, of freedom. For once, I was away from the protective arms of my mother. And I was able to do whatever I chose. And for someone like myself, who was shot away for so long, it was exhilarating when a door opened. And I always, inevitably, taken advantage of that. And I don't say it in the wrong way. So, a big door opened for me in 1974. I was privileged to go to an institution, Auburn College, an institution that instilled in me the desire to give back, to keep the faith, that gave me security in my knowledge and my abilities. And then another day of recognition and, yes, reckoning came in 2006, when Civic Ventures, sometimes I thought by mistake, elected to give me the first Purpose Prize as recognition of the work I was doing. It was the first time that I heard that I was a social entrepreneur. I thought that I was just simply a troublemaker, a stubborn person who really was concerned about issues in my community. That Purpose Prize changed my life and my work forever. It has never been business as usual in my little office, which actually is in the back of my house in the garage. This is where I work. My resolve was threatened. I was so inspired walking into a room the day of the award and finding over 200 people there, most of them much older than I was, tackling and succeeding in the most difficult problems confronting our community. And I said to myself, they too want to leave evidence that they exist. And I think most of the social entrepreneurs that I know want to leave some kind of evidence that they lived here and they left something behind. Then, this year, I was again surprised by becoming an Ashoka Fellow. And it renewed my sense of responsibility and also my resolve in actually changing national policy, which is my ultimate goal, my legacy in a sense, my little scratch in the world. I felt that I have changed behavior at the very individual level. I have given a voice to those who did not have one. I have created, 40 or more successful projects in 23 states Next week, we are going to start a project in Biloxi. We'll be able to see the damage firsthand. But I had not been able to change the mentality of those who make policy for us every day. So I decided that this is my chance, that my timing is right. With all those awards and recognition, that I'm ready to tackle government. And again, for me, at least as I see it, the timing is right, because I always believe that altruism is part of us, is part of human beings, that us as social beings, we are compassionate. We have shown it in every crisis, in Haiti, in everywhere. We go and help our neighbors. But I know now, given this global society in which we live, that we now realize that in order to survive as human beings, we have to connect with others, and we have to be altruistic. And the age of indifference is over. We cannot cross our arms and say, it's none of our business. And this is replacing apathy with empathy, because apathy remains the one major obstacle for every social entrepreneur that I have met in producing and effecting permanent social change. So, why do I say it's right? Because government has never been so distasteful, distrustful, and lacking so much confidence among people. They do have a crisis, and they usually act when there is a crisis. Well, they have a human capital crisis. I met people that work for government, and they say almost shamefully that they work for government. I mean, all this crisis, all this corruption, all this problem have eroded the trust that we once had in our government to solve issues. I call it the spiritual blind side. They act as if they are afraid of dealing with social and moral issues. So they do have a problem bringing talented people to government. So they are in a big, huge need to export talented individuals with public interest in mind, committed to outcomes. And to me, that's the definition of a social entrepreneur. So we have come of age. They need us more today than ever before. And this crisis also exists in corporate America, because again, of all the blundering and the problems we have had, they are already enacting social programs. And I mentioned one example only. Starbucks has started a campaign, I don't know whether you have heard about it, I'm In. They are providing millions of hours of social service hours and establishing community programs. And I just cannot imagine a world that serves. Most of our problems will be over if we have a cadre of people committed to serving others. We will not have elders in nursing homes anymore. They will be living at home and dying with dignity. Another opportunity that had just arisen is this whole meltdown of housing. And I thought, my daughter is my partner, I thought that was the end of us. I said, well, we're going down with everybody else, because, I mean, it has opened such a huge door to us, because guess what private investors are doing with all those distressed properties, those empty lands? They're not going to do upper-end condominiums or luxury hotels because nobody will come, even if they build them. So they are taking those properties at a very reduced price, and guess what? They're doing affordable housing for the first time, and they're putting services there as well, because I think it's criminal to do elderly housing without a component of service. They may not be there very, very long. So we have started several partnerships with for-profit tax credit developers, and we are actually creating 5 different projects in Pennsylvania, Indiana, Vermont, and catering to those who do not have enough. In closing, and I like to answer as many questions as you have, in closing, I want to say, and I want to remind all of you, that big innovations have always been created on the basis of rejection. Think back in history, and you will see that this is true. I think it's the right time to do the right thing. I believe that those who have initiated change, like myself and millions of others, are in a better position today to manage that change. I thank you very much for coming and for listening, and I'd be happy to answer all your questions. Thank you.
Hunch, you can just stay up.
I stay here?
Yeah.
I like this position.
Oh, good. You're in authority.
Oh, boy.
I want to thank Conchi Bretos, founder of MIA Consulting, Ashoka Fellow, and Purpose Priest Peace Prize winner, as well as Angel, to thousands of elderly throughout the country for coming. I had hoped by bringing you here, Conchi, you could inspire everyone who heard you, and you certainly didn't let me down.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. That's the last thing I wanted to do.
So let me just start with one question first. And I would encourage everyone, even though you have to get up and walk over there, we want this to be as interactive as possible. Could you just describe the business model of MIA Consulting and how it differs from the status quo ante?
How it differs to the way, I mean, assisted living facilities or housing in rich, service in rich housing has been there for many years. The difference in the model that we develop, I never act alone, brings services to individuals. And we started bringing services to public housing individuals because the need was there. What we do that others don't do, a lot of the private assisted living, and many of you would know that private assisted living industry caters to all those who can sign a check every month and have, you don't depend on government subsidy. Government subsidy is a hairy business. And what we did is we stack that service housing subsidies. We have subsidies coming from U.S. HUD in the way of rental subsidies, utility subsidies. We have subsidies coming up from Health and Human Services. And by the way, I forgot to mention something very important about HUD and HHS. Back in 2003, I was silly enough to meet with two federal agencies because I thought it was logical that they, one housing and one services, should join hands. They don't talk to each other, rarely talk to each other. Form a partnership to facilitate housing and services. We brought enormous amount of people. There were about 100 people in a room from all the sectors, all the aspects of the issue, financial institution, housing authorities, advocates, legislators, they all thought that what a great idea, bring them both together, sign the partnership, one puts the money for the housing, one puts the money for the services. It was a win-win situation for everybody. Today, 2010, that partnership is in limbo. They have refused to sign the partnership, the MOU, just because it's not one of their priority, just because there's a lot of politics involved, just because they do not understand. So what I've been doing against the wind is that every time I go to a state, I negotiate Medicaid waivers. That was what I did in Tallahassee. I understand that monster very well. And I've learned to understand the other monster, public housing. Each of them have 50 pounds of regulations and categorical funding. So what our model does that is not being done enough, and there are very few people who are doing it in the United States today, that might change if these two agencies get together, is that we bring to the table all that funding and we manage it and we comply with the regulations. And so the individual that lives in that facility, that's the place where they live all their lives, don't have to bother with whether the Medicaid waiver came through or whether the funding was approved. We have created Medicaid programs in 5 states. I used to be a lobby. I'm very good at getting money, not for me, but for my work. Getting money for me is difficult. And so we created Medicaid waiver programs in Pennsylvania, in Tennessee, in Ohio, in West Virginia, which was a shock to me because I thought that would be the last place, and also in Florida. They were not before providing funding there. So I understand all these mechanisms. They cannot tell me a story about whether it can or cannot be done. I understand the system. I know how to work it. So I think that in a nutshell is that we do things that other people, or at least the private service organizations, don't want to do because it's unpredictable, because it's difficult, because there's too many regulations, because there's too much supervision. And we go to their homes. CBS News had another bright moment in my life. I was interviewed by Katie Couric. They did a CBS News program on my work. And they did a lot of research. And this is how I sell my program to the policymakers in the federal and state government. For every person that I provide services in their home, I'm saving the Medicaid budget $18,000 a year. And now you multiply that by the 5,000 people who are already today being served at home. We are cutting the Medicaid program, which is a big budgetary issue in every state in this country, by millions of dollars. And that's why they give us the money. Altruism is not already there. They want to cut spending in the Medicaid program, and we have the way to do it.
So, Kanchi, when you spoke about the need to affect political change now, I mean, you have been trying to affect political change and get, you know, Health and Human Services together with. What are the next steps that you would like to see happen in terms of policy change at the federal level and the state level?
I am tired of being a bastard child. Mm-hmm. I want to become official, and that's what I want the state, the federal government to do, to adopt this project as an official program of them. They have other programs where they service the home nurse, the children, and so on. So I want them to say, Yes, the poor seniors and disabled adults in this country are our responsibility, and we need to provide for them. And that's what I'm trying to do. 2 weeks ago, HUD and HHS, and I is coming, mm-hmm. and I'm going to be in their faces until it happens. 2 weeks ago, HHS and HUD signed a memorandum of understanding and created a program to service disabled adults, non-elderly. They cannot be 65 years and older, so that they can remain in their homes and transition from nursing home. The reason why they have done this and they have used the model that I discussed with them is because there's something called the Olmstead Act. And it was a group of disabled adults that were put in institutions, hospitals, and they raised bloody hell. And they actually sued the government. And now they want to be able to cater to those people. And so I say to the seniors in this country, you have to raise bloody hell. Mm-hmm. You have to, if necessary, take legal action, because this is a right that you have. So I think in a short while, we are going to see the elderly being included in this memorandum of understanding and this partnership.
But when you say to the seniors, you have to raise bloody hell, you're talking about a group of people who you yourself said have been disenfranchised for years, most of their lives. So what's the reaction to that?
It's a different mentality to this baby boomer generation. I'm a baby boomer. I was part of two huge movements in this country. We know how to put them together. We know how to fuel them, civic rights movement, the women's movement. Our generation will not be put aside or be silenced. We are trendsetters. We demand change, and we're going to get it. But the generation before us, the generation of my parents, were not of that caliber. They suffer in resignation. They believe to a point that they deserve the treatment they're getting. So it's very difficult to actually mobilize them. They feel that it's not proper to do that. And that's the main obstacle, is that you can give them a voice, you can tell them where injustice is happening, but they themselves have to mobilize themselves. And I only know of an organization, AARP, that knows how to do that very well. I worked for them for 2 years.
Hi. I have a question about healthcare.
Yes.
As the population gets older, obviously people get more and more concerned about their health care. We've just had the huge Obamacare package that was passed.
Yes.
What impact do you think all of this is going to have on senior Americans and older Americans in the next 10 to 20 years? And are you optimistic about that, or are you concerned?
I've lived in countries like Australia where they have national health insurance, and I always thought of national health insurance, so I'm biased in a way, is a right that we all have, the same thing as free education. So I was very pleased with this healthcare reform, and that's one of the changes that I see happening, which have led me to believe that almost everything is possible today. I don't think it's going to impact seniors in a great way. Remember, healthcare reform, the whole impetus behind healthcare reform has been to provide healthcare insurance to those 40 million people who do not have it now. Now, we're going to see some cuts in Medicare. We already seen that. I don't foresee any cuts in Medicaid because it's going to be counterproductive. But I see healthcare reform as the vehicle for propelling this whole idea that individuals need to remain at home, that we need to change their lifestyle, which is something that we do in every facility that we have. We change the way they eat, we supervise their medication, we exercise them, both their physically and their brain, and so their lifestyle changes and their health improve. We evaluated all the programs that we have done so far, and we have seen people who were in wheelchair walking. We see people who had 21 medications, talking about cost of prescription drugs, drop down to 5 or 6. We have seen individuals contain their health issues like diabetes and blood pressure. So the program is not only provide services so that they live with dignity. The real mission of our project is to make them healthier, to keep them healthier. And that's going to be a great component of this whole healthcare reform. And those programs that are able to do that, cut costs, avoid hospitalization, emergency room care, prescription drugs, it's going to be a program that the administration is going to support. So we feel that we are going to actually have another high point.
I have a very different view for the moment. First of all, let me tell you that I am pre-baby boomers. Mm-hmm. Oh. So I don't have much faith in the baby boomers at this point. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen them step up. And I'm concerned about that. The other concern I have, just to share with you, is that I am very concerned about when we talk about this being something that the government should do. And my own experiences going for family, friends, relatives into living assistance homes, no matter what the level, poor to affluent, what I see is a disconnect in the family situation. In my own life, what I remind my sons constantly is that I'm here. And when I can't take care of myself, I expect them to be there to fight for me. In the meantime, I'm going to fight as hard as I can for me as I have for them. So I'm concerned about generalities, and I am concerned that the people I saw and were engaged in, I come out of the Civil Rights War and poverty movement, have not come forward to be more assertive. I don't know what's happened, and I don't have faith that the baby boomers, as large as they are, have taken on that sense of themselves that they need to take responsibility and not just shift it to the government. I don't trust the government taking care of
Nobody
me.
Nobody does.
Yeah. So I it's a challenge.
Sure.
You refer to the baby boomers, and I'm not there with you on that they're in this fight. How do we get them engaged? How do we talk to them? The Great Panthers, I think, is a wonderful movement that happened pre-baby boomers. How do we get this conversation going in our society that, as you were talking about, is a society cultural environment? It's a big question, and I'm just going to throw
question,
it out.
It's a good question, though. Thank
Excellent.
You.
Thank you very much. The conversation is going on. And maybe because I'm in the trenches, I hear it all the time. And I'm not, by nature, a very optimistic person. In fact, I've been rather pessimistic. The baby boomers will act on self-interest, like all of us. I don't want to end up in a nursing home. I want to remain in my community with my dogs and my cats and my grandchildren the way I was raised to be, but... So they would act in order to avoid being put away. And you hear it all the times. We read articles. I mean, the baby boomers, they're also called the sandwich generation, as you well know. We take care, like I take care of my mother, and I take care of my children, and we're sandwiching. And there is a real crisis in caregiving in America. We have to go out and work, not because we want to work, because there is a need for a woman to go out and work, and yet we need to take care of our seniors. My experience has been dealing with poor seniors, most of them who have migrated to Florida or Arizona. They're very much alone, and the children drop them there and they disappear. They come once a month. It's not a general thing, but people like you or like me who think, I cannot do that, I cannot drop my mother and come and visit her once every 6 months, they do that. They're very much alone. They have no family. And when sometimes the family becomes an issue in their care. So to answer your question, the baby boomers are going to come to the table when the time comes for them to suffer or to endure a situation like we have today. They are confronted with a crisis. There are not enough caregivers. The baby boomers, we have not had enough children, as you well know. So we're not going to have, I mean, that's a whole dream, that we're going to have children who will keep us at home and take care of us. That's not a reality. And so we realize that there are not going to be enough children there to take care of us. And at the same time, they're not saving for the day where they're not able to work. There are very few that actually have some kind of insurance. Now, the government, like I said before, I respect some people that have helped me and I found to have some kind of enlightened desire to do things right. They're very few. The government, unfortunately, has, in my book, has to provide for some basic things. Corporate America is not going to do it. They're driven by profit. I cannot imagine, and you can talk about the crisis of government and their inability to deal with social issues, but corporate America has also been unable to deal with those issues. So I think that we ourselves, the baby boomers, and I'm a late boomer, need to come to the table and negotiate what is right. And the government will have to be a partner to all this. We cannot leave them out. I wish I could, but we cannot leave them out. But we have to negotiate with them, redirect their efforts, gain their confidence. When I'm talking to them, everything I'm doing, I let them believe that it is their idea, that it's their project. Otherwise, I know it's going to fail. So there are ways of approaching it, and there are people in government that are good, and if we belong and we get involved in the business of government, then it will happen.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program and our guest and television on the internet program. And our guest is Conchi Bretos, who is discussing ways to allow low-income elderly to stay in their homes and maintain a higher quality of life. Next question.
I have a question that's more about housing than about maybe the elderly. I think what's really interesting about your model is you found a cost savings through lower health care and provision of services that actually saves money and has a business model around it. I think if we look at just low-income housing in general, the thing that comes to mind are the projects, a place that's unsafe. And I'm sure some of this is stereotype and some of it is true, but do you see any other movement happening with assisted housing where there's other people trying to find this kind of business model, or are there lessons from your work that we can apply to that larger question of public housing?
Public housing was started back in 1935 via the Housing Act. So most of the buildings that you see, public housing buildings, are actually very old buildings. And they, because nobody wanted them in their backyard, they actually situated in crime-infected neighborhoods. That was the case of Helen Sawyer Plaza. Helen Sawyer Plaza was in the middle of Overtown. I don't know whether you... Overtown was the site of mobs and all kinds of criminal activities back in the 1980s. You couldn't go there at any time during the day. And when we got there, that was the case of Helen Sawyer. The cars were vandalized. There was a prostitution ring going on the second floor. Every day there was a piece of equipment missing. So we started Helen Sawyer Plaza, 24-hour supervision. We had guards, 24-hour guards. And when we started, there were 10, 15 police reports a day. And 3 years later, there were none. There were chopping areas that grew around the area. If you go there today, it's actually a very nice neighborhood. So you by producing a change in one building, in one community, you actually can, it has a ripple effect, in a sense. Public housing has been on an economic crisis for the last 5 years. They have never received sufficient funding for programs or for retrofitting building, as was the case of Helen Sawyer Plaza. This year, for the first time in the last, I would say, 6-7 years, funding has been restored. There's capital grants, there's subsidies coming in, new funding. What HUD is trying to do today, and housing has two programs. One is called public housing. They're the buildings owned by the housing authority. And there's something called Section 8 vouchers. It's a voucher. You take that anywhere in the United States, and you pay 30% of whatever the rent is. They think that the Section 8 vouchers that give freedom of to people to live not only in a complex that may be located in a deplorable community, that they can go and live, for example, in Florida in Coral Gables, mm-hmm. where rich people live. Beautiful building, beautiful garden. So HUD, at this moment, has a piece of legislation to convert all of public housing into Section 8. In other words, there will not be physical buildings anymore. There will be vouchers that can be assigned to a building or can be assigned to an individual, and then they will have the freedom to choose where they want to live. So I think changes are being made as far as housing is concerned. I think the changes that are being made are good and are going to improve the current situation. It is very difficult, and it has been for me, because when housing started back in 1935, it says so in writing, we are just a roof. We provide nothing but a roof. So it becomes very difficult to negotiate with this housing authority director, some of which have no business acumen whatsoever. They're there because they're probably buying time until retirement. They want to keep things predictable. It's very difficult to tell them, you're wrong. Under that roof, there are people, and they are your responsibility, and you have to provide services for them. But some, a small number, are hearing the conversation. And if HUD starts, and this is money-driven, Helen Sawyer Plaza was a reality because there was money there, because I brought the money, because I generated income. If he had not done so, he would have died. The Medicaid program funds this because I'm cutting Medicaid budget. So it's all driven by money. And when they see the housing authorities that they're actually producing new revenue that they can use for whatever they want, then they get very excited about it. And they take that leap of faith and they start doing things outside the box, as they say it. And I think that when money becomes available through subsidies or through generating new income, that they are going to be enticed and motivated to adopt my model more so than they have done so far. Thank you very much.
Hello.
Hi.
Your conversation's been very poignant for me. I have an elderly mother who's at home suffering from Parkinson's disease and has been in and out of rehab centers and nursing homes, and fortunately right now is at home. My question is around the services that you've mentioned several times that you feel are, and I agree, necessary to accompany the model. I can tell you what a challenge it's been for my sister and I to find quality, consistent, meaningful care to help my mom at home, and we can pay. You know, I'm just wondering what that looks like in terms of the residents in these communities that you've created. What kind of service? How does that look like? How does it get paid for, et cetera?
The model that we started back in 1995 has changed. We're now creating what we call continuum of care. In other words, like in Biloxi, Mississippi, there's a building for independent living. We're doing another one in Key West, and then there's an assisted living facility next door. It's true that the services, that is hard to find good quality services. Because we're not for profit, and because we're not driven to generate money, we keep the quality of services very high. Besides, we started all this because of a moral obligation. We didn't start all this because we wanted to make money. In fact, we don't make much money. So how does it happen? There are providers that are good. I know them, I met them, and they usually are individuals who do have a financial incentive, but also have some kind of moral obligation. And the only way that we have maintained high quality services is because we monitor. We are on top of those people. We hire the creme of the creme. We don't provide any medical services. These are mostly single mothers with lots of children that work there. And their job is to clean. They clean individuals. They clean apartments. We have cooks. We actually have chefs that produce meals. And we provide them, which is not customary in the service industry, we provide them with fringe benefit. They have 401k, they have health and dental insurance, they make more money than anybody else, they have vacation time, they have sick days. So I think that it is important to hire high-quality people. Our administrator, which is the person in charge of the day-to-day operation, makes a lot of money. They make anywhere from $80,000 to $100,000 a year. They're very experienced. We are overlooking what they're doing day in, day out. We ensure that the residents speak out. If there's something they don't like, we provide them some sort of coverage to talk about the issues without knowing. They're very afraid, many of them. If I say that somebody has molested me or has neglected or exploited me, if I say something, I'm going to be thrown out of here. And we make sure that that doesn't happen. So that has allowed us to really have a communication with the residents to keep. We have a quality assurance program that we monitor every day. It's an uphill battle. It is. And I know where you're coming from. Is my mother, we are able to pay, and we have somebody living with her and now because she's not able to bathe herself or cook for herself. And we're there every day. We want to know what she's doing and how Mama is feeling. And we have gone through 5 people in the last 2 years. It's not easy, but I would say my advice to you is that you even though you don't care for them yourself, you have to be very vigilant.
Thank you. And we have time for one last question. You have to give a succinct answer, Conch.
The what? A succinct. Oh, boy. That's the most difficult job I have had.
Hopefully this is a quick question. I actually am the director of resident services for a large affordable housing developer in the Bay Area.
Wonderful.
Both tax credit and HUD housing for seniors and special needs populations.
Yes.
And you've mentioned outcomes and the impact of services, and we obviously truly believe in the impact of services on allowing our residents to age in place and live happy, healthy lives.
Yes.
Which programs, in your opinion, have the most impact, and can you direct me to resources that, or studies that really demonstrate that impact, and as well as the cost savings of providing resident services in affordable housing? Is that a quick question? I'm not
no.
sure.
And
it's
you will
a tough
have
question.
To give me your email, and I'll send
will
you
do.
Some of the studies. just one program that we have done, just one. Nursing homes are full of Alzheimer's people. You know that. They're not sick. They don't belong there. So my job has been to rescue them. And I do that every month. I just take them out in the middle of the night or on the weekend. We have found out that by not segregating the Alzheimer's, in other words, they're part of the community. We have never had an elopement in the 15 years. They actually improve. The cognitive health improves. One program that we are doing in the facility that we have in St. Petersburg, Florida, we have programs that start at 9 p.m. at night because that's the most difficult time for them. So we take them up. We massage them. We paint their nails. We go out for a coffee and drink or to the movies. And we come back at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And we have measured their cognitive health. And the improvement has been tremendous. They don't wander anymore. They do not become combative anymore. They seem to remember a lot more their relatives when they see them. So they're common sense.
They're exhausted, I think. Right?
Yes, they're so tired. All they want to do is sleep. But before, we used to medicate them so that they go to sleep or lock them up. And the more we hear and we learn about Alzheimer's, the more things we're going to do. But we cannot assume that those individuals have to remain in that vegetative condition.
Okay. Thank you very much, Conchi. That's a good note to end on. Thank you for being an inspiration to us all. We also want to thank our funders, Skoll and W.K. Kellogg Foundations and the Omidyar Network. Today's program has been the second in the Commonwealth Club's Social Entrepreneurship Series. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.